Hechel Menachem presents A Tale of Two Souls, an ongoing lecture series on the Tanya by Rabbi Yosef Yitzchak Jacobson. This is recording number 141 in the series entitled, Where is God? Between God's Essence and Our Experience of Him. This class was recorded live at Hechel Menachem, Brooklyn, New York, during the winter of 5762.
Chaydish tonight, which, as I said the words, I realized the connection to the 51st chapter in Tanya, which discusses in depth, like nowhere else in Tanya, the unique role and function of the head, of the brain, within the human organism. And as Dr. Rebbe explains in other discourses, that what he explains here in Tanya concerning the human organism is also true about time. What exists within human beings also exists in time, and it exists in space. In time, the brain of the year is Rosh Hashanah, and the brain of every month is Rosh Chodesh. So on Rosh Hashanah, you have the central nervous system that encompasses the energy of every single day of the year. That's why we don't sleep on Rosh Hashanah, as it's brought in Shulchan Aruch, because you don't want to have a fashlofen ayar, because if the brain is fashlofen, so the entire body is fashlofen. And in a more specific fashion, that energy itself is then divided within into 12 parts, and every month has its unique central nervous system, the Rosh Chodesh, which is the brain for the entire month. Now, in the 51st chapter of the Tanya, which I am determined to culminate tonight, with Hashem's help, I should say, and Bli Neder. A mensch tracht, und Gott lacht, is Yiddish saying. Man thinks and Hashem laughs, but it doesn't rhyme in English. A man proposes and God disposes. Thank you. So in the 51st chapter of Tanya and in our previous classes, the Alter Rebbe taught us that when we talk about the soul within us, when we address the neshama that exists and finds itself within each and every single one of us, we must differentiate between three dimensions of the soul. When we talk about the soul, we have to distinguish between three components. First is the soul as she is in her pristine, original condition, so to speak. The soul as she is in her essence. What type of being is the soul? So the Alter Rebbe said that in our vocabulary, we do not have the words or the terms to describe it. We cannot describe the soul, not in physical terms, nor even in spiritual terms. Even to describe the soul in terms of being a source of life, a source of personality for the human being, which are spiritual entities, these also fall short of describing what the soul is. You cannot describe and say, what is the soul? Intelligence. What is the soul? Consciousness. What is the soul? Awareness, emotions, love, and so forth. To say that the soul is energy, vitality, personality, is simply inaccurate. It does not define or encapsulate its innate reality. Now we come to the second stage. This stage plays itself out when the soul meets up one of its best friends in this world, or its best friend in this world, the brain. When the soul meets up the brain, here a second stage is actualized or revealed. The brain has been designed by its creator as a conducive entity to pick up certain signals of the soul that the brain can relate to. The innate nature of the soul, the brain doesn't pick up, it doesn't relate to it. Its physiological and cellular structure could not appreciate or experience the innate essence of the soul, which is really indescribable. In terms, it's an indivisible essence. We can't even talk about it. We can't define it in any terms that we can relate to. It's totally transcendental of our language. But the brain does pick up from the soul some signals that it does relate to. Or to put it in other words, the brain picks up from the infinite tunes of the soul, it picks up particular tunes, particular melodies, namely, the soul as a source of life, the soul as the spiritual DNA of the body, the soul as a spiritual blueprint for the entire makeup and composition for the body, or in the Alter Rebbe's words, the brain picks up 613 notes of the soul, those notes that can then give life and function to the 316 corresponding limbs and nerves of the human body. So the brain draws out from an indivisible soul particular characteristics that it is sensitive to, that it relates to, and the brain actualizes them in a concrete form. So the soul has within it the soul has within it a spiritual map of the body. The brain has a physical map of the body. When the two maps meet, they create a miniature globe. Together, they create the miracle of human life. But the brain has not been designed to appreciate or experience the pristine nature of the soul. This transcends completely the tissue, the fiber, the composition of the brain, and therefore it is found in the entire body identically, because it's not found in the body by the virtue of the body experiencing it, rather it's found in the body by virtue of its own endless capacity. And therefore it's found in the brain and in the toe identically. In the brain itself, the second stage, the soul as it's experienced and actualized in the brain, there are also a few stages. The Alter Rebbe was very wordy when he was describing the brain, because in the brain itself he was describing and alluding to different stages. First, there is the brain as it brings to fore the entire energy and all of the functions of the body in one unified, singular fashion. There is the element of the brain in which the entire map of the body is included as one. all of the functions, the 613 notes of this particular melody are included as one. There's another element in the brain where it possesses in already an individualistic fashion the distinct features of the entire body, which means there are different chambers in the brain which are uniquely connected with various functions of the body. So the brain takes the 613 functions of the body, of the soul, and it creates already an outline in the brain where it maps out the entire body in the different chambers of the brain. In the cerebrum, as we call it today, you already have particular nerves that are connected to each particular function of the body, whether it's hearing or seeing or speaking or language or communication or mobility or reproduction and so on, and circulation and so on and so forth. That's the second stage, the soul as it's in the brain. And finally, you have the third stage. The brain allocates and transmits the vitality and the functions of the soul to each of the limbs of the body through the nervous system, through the blood, which is transmitted to the entire body from the central nervous system in the brain and in the spine all the way down till the toe and every other part of the human body. So we have three stages. We have the soul in its pristine state. We have the soul as it meets up and it experiences a marriage with the brain. And then you have the soul as it is experienced and enclosed within the individualistic limbs, organs, tissue, of course, neurons of the entire body, from head all the way to toe. These three stages we discussed at length in previous weeks. Now all of this serves the Alter Rebbe as an introduction to explain an apparent contradiction between two fundamentals in Yiddishkeit. On one hand we say, Malaycha l'aretz kvoidei, the earth is filled with Hashem's presence, or in the Zoharic expression, Leisa sar poniminei, there is no space devoid of His presence. On the other hand, we talk about the Shechina, the divine presence dwelling in a particular place, more than in another place. How are these two things to be reconciled? If we were to say only that the divine presence is more apparent in a particular location, no. Leisa sar poniminei, there's no place devoid of Him. But some places He may be concealed, and in other locations He is more transparent. The husk is not as dense. The shell is not as thick. But we in Yiddishkeit, in Torah, we find the discussion of not only Hashem's Shechina being more accessible or more revealed in particular places, but rather we say that in this place the Shechina dwells, unlike it is found in any other place. How are we to reconcile this with the other fundamental fundamental doctrine in Jewish faith that Hashem fills everything and is everywhere? Particularly addresses Kodesh HaKadoshim, the Holy of Holies, where the Torah teaches that there in the Holy of Holies there was a special indwelling and in presence of the Shechina, v'shachanti b'seichem, I will dwell in the Beis HaMikdash unlike I dwell anywhere else, and especially in the Holy of Holies. Again, revelation I can understand in the Holy of Holies more than anywhere else, in the Holy Temple more than anywhere else. In other places in Chassidus is discussed that when it comes to revelation, sometimes the opposite is true. That particularly in a place of impurity, in a place where holiness is a unique luxury, so sometimes over there it is easier for a human being to access and experience the Shechina more than in another place. And the explanation is an interesting one. Because since Malaycha L'aretz Kvoidei, since Hashem fills everything, and every place. So in a place of real impurity and defilement, the Shekhinah is, so to speak, desperate to be expressed, so it will be revealed even within a relatively simple human being's heart. For example, if you have a genius, a great genius, who finds himself among great scholars with whom he can share his wisdom, he's not going to exchange a conversation with a simpleton, with a peasant. It's below his dignity. But if he finds himself in a forest, and the only company he has is undomesticated beasts, so even a simple human being becomes suitable, at least I can express myself somewhat. There's a story about the holy Rabbinim of Pshischa. Before he became a master, a Hasidic master, he was a merchant, and he would travel to Danzig, a city in Germany, each year or a few times a year. When he would return from Danzig, he would go one Shabbos to the Yid HaKadosh, a great master known as the Holy Yid, the Yid HaKadosh, and another next Shabbos to the Seir of Lublin, the Holy Chayz of Lublin. Once he arrived, came from Danzig, and he came to the Seir of Lublin, the second Shabbos. He went in to give shalom to his Rebbe and to be welcomed by him, and the Seer of Lublin ignored him. So he thought, no, maybe it was a coincidence. He came back a day later, he comes in again, and the Rebbe is totally ignoring him. So he realized that it's not a coincidence, it's intentional. So he starts reflecting and becoming introspective. Perhaps he has committed some sin, perhaps he has behaved immorally, and the Seer of Lublin is having a difficult time tolerating him. But he reflects, and he can't come up with anything. On the contrary, he remembers that in Danzig, he actually felt a profound surge of spirituality. And with that surge, he happened to be Makariv. He happened to bring closer some of the German, secular, enlightened Jews, so to speak, to Yiddishkeit, to Torah, which Rabbinim was very involved in. And he would call them the Deitschen, the Deitschelach, the German Jews that were much more secular than the Eastern European Jews because of emancipation came there and didn't really arrive to Russia or Poland. And he felt, on the contrary, that in Danzig he was uplifted. Danzig he was uplifted spiritually. So he thought about the Gemara in Brachas Dav Ches. Pishpish v'loy matza. The Gemara talks about when you examine your own life and you're becoming introspective and you don't find anything, you don't find any sin. Yitla b'bitl teira. You should attribute it to Bittul Torah. If a person is suffering and he looks into himself and he doesn't find any negative sin, so you should attribute it to Bittul Torah. The fact that he did not use his time properly, he squandered his minutes and his hours when he could have engaged himself in studying Hashem's Torah. So he thought, in Danzig, I haven't sinned, on the contrary. But Bittul Torah, I did in Danzig. I went for a business trip. I couldn't learn as I usually do. So he sat down in Lublin and he began learning all day and all night. He didn't stop learning. In the middle of the learning, he comes up with an original interpretation for the Gemara. Pishpish v'loy matza. If you're searching for a negative quality within yourself and you can't find it, Yitla b'bittul Torah. Not you should attribute the negative quality to Bittul Torah. Because in this case, he went for business and it was permissible. He couldn't learn. Yitla b'bittul Torah. He should attribute the fact that he didn't find the stain within himself to Bittul Torah. Not he should attribute his sin to Bittul Torah. He should attribute the fact that he's not, the fact that he has become insensitive to his fall, to the fact that he's not learning. Because when a person learns Torah, he internalizes a higher vision and he becomes sensitive to stains, to blemishes, to dysfunction, to spiritual disease that other people could be totally insensitive to. So he continued to learn more. And after a whole night of learning, he realized that in Danzig, he felt a spiritual surge and that gave him a tinge of arrogance. He felt good with himself. He comes back to the Seer of Lublin. When he walks in the Seer of Lublin, smiles and gives him a broad Shalom Aleichem. And he says, Reb Simcha Binim, you have to understand, in Danzig Shchinta Begalusa, in dancing the Shchinta is in exile. He said in Yiddish, B'meila, V'nar, Epes Abissala Erlich Yid, Klepzich on the Shchinta. If in dancing, somewhat of a Jew with a little bit spiritual sensitivity, the Shechina attracts itself to him. It gravitates to him like bees to honey. So when you were in dancing, you felt an explosion of the Shechina, but there's no need to feel arrogant. If you were the same person would be walking in the streets of Poland, he said, you would feel nothing. So that's where sometimes the Shechina is revealed, particularly in a place of impurity and unholiness. Not because of your greatness. He thought it was because of, doesn't have to, on the contrary. It needs anything. It finds a little branch that can hold on to it, expresses itself there. But again, this is all when you're dealing with the revelation of the Divine Presence. When you're dealing with the presence of the Shechina, that is identical everywhere in Danzig, as in Jerusalem, as in the Holy of Holies. So how do we reconcile these two doctrines? So the Alter Rebbe attempted to explain this by prefacing it with understanding the nature of the relationship between the soul and the body, and the three stages in this relationship. The soul in its pristine state, the soul as it's experienced in the brain, and the soul as it's experienced within the particular limbs and organs of the body. So now we'll be able to continue inside, with Alter Rebbe goes to describe and begin to answer the original question of the chapter. Zogt Alter Rebbe, it's on page 143 on the top, the large words, I am Beza Med Aleph, the Kocha Mamash Al Derech Moshe. The Kocha Mamash Al Derech Moshe, in a truly similar fashion, but only figuratively speaking, an interesting combination of words which is found often in the Tanya, the Kocha Mamish, Mamish like this, but only Al Derech Mashal. Figuratively speaking, it's Mamish like this. The Alter Rebbe cautions us to always remember that there is an infinite gap between human metaphors and true divinity. So all of our anthropom, all of our discussions as far as godliness and its relationship to the world, we have to remember that it's al derech mashal, figuratively speaking. Ein sof baruch hu mamale kol almin lach yosam. The Ein sof, blessed be He, the endless one, blessed be He, fills all the worlds in order to animate them. Just as He addressed the soul right in the beginning, and He said, the soul itself fill the entire body. The very essence of the soul fills every part of the body from head to toe identically. So He says, Ein Sof fills all of the worlds in order to animate them. And when I mean all of the worlds, He says, I mean all of the worlds. And that includes, B'chol Oilom Yash Bruyim Lein Ketz V'Tachlis. In each world, there are creatures without limit or end. Myriads upon myriads of various grades of angels, of souls, and so on and so forth. So in each world, you have literally, he says, limitless creatures, if we're talking about angels or we're talking about souls, one grade above another grade, spiritually speaking. The chain. What else do you have besides angels and souls? You have hechalos. You have spheros.
These are organic in a sense.
V'chein ribuy olam es ein lekeitz gvul. So too, in addition to the creatures and beings within each world, the worlds themselves, there is an abundance of worlds, so too is the abundance of the worlds without end or limit. Gavaya al gavaya chuli, one higher than the other, and so on. And despite all of these myriads of gradations and ranks and level, levels. There are worlds without limits. In each world itself, there are creatures without end. Nonetheless, we say that Ein Seif Baruch Hu, the endless one, fills all and everything. And he begins to explain. V'hine, now, Mahu Seivatz Musi Shal Ein Seif Baruch Hu, the core and the essence of the blessed endless one, Shave Bel Yoinim V'tachtoinim, is identical in the higher and lower realms, in the higher and lower worlds, K'mashal HaNeshama HaNiskeres Leil, as in the example of the soul mentioned above. With Alter Rebbe explained that the soul's core and essence is not divisible, it's not compartmentalized, it cannot be said that it is found in the brain to a greater extent than it is found in the hands or in the feet. So just as we discussed about the soul, that the soul in its essence is not found in the brain more than in the feet, the same is true about the essence of the Ein Sof and its relationship to the worlds. And the reason is also the same. And Alter Rebbe explains, Ukamashakasov b'tikunim, as it is written in Tikunim, in the section of Zohar known as Tikuni Zohar, which is a section of the Zohar that includes 70 interpretations on the word of Bereshis, that is the Tikuni Zohar. There are 70 Tikunim, 70 explanations for the word Bereshis, and in this part of Zohar, actually in its introduction that many Jews say Friday afternoon, known as Pasach Elio, which is introduction of the Tikkuni Zohar, we say the following statement, the Iyu Stimu Dechol Stimin, that he is hidden from all the hidden. And Alter Rebbe explains here, interestingly, what does this mean? Pirush, this means, and whenever he says Pirush, he's trying to negate something. If you would read the Akdama, the introduction, you might say, what does stimu the chol stimin mean? He is hidden. He is hidden from all the hidden, you could say. He is more hidden than all of the hidden things. There are hidden things that are extremely hidden and extremely concealed. And Hashem is stimu the chol stimin. He is even more hidden than all the hidden things. That's how aloof and remote he is. So the Alter Rebbe says, no, Pirushit means Da'afilu ba'al min stimin delayl, that even in the higher hidden worlds, Husasum v'nelem b'soicham, he is hidden and concealed within them, K'moysho sasum v'nelem b'tachtonim, just as he is hidden and concealed in the lower worlds. Stimu d'chol stimin doesn't mean he's more hidden even than the hidden. It means he is hidden even from those that are hidden. Even from those worlds that are hidden for us. Why are they hidden from us? Because they're so spiritual, they're so godly, they're so transcendental. And therefore, they are totally obscured from our earthly vision. Yet, Hashem is stimu d'chol stimin. He is hidden from them and inexperienced by them and unaccessed by them as much as he is hidden from us. In the same identical fashion. Why? Ki leis machshava tfisa beklal. For no thought can apprehend him at all. No thought, even the highest, can grasp him in any fashion whatsoever. Afilu ba'olam ha'alyonim, even a thought of the highest worlds, of the higher worlds, which is totally a different type of thought. But nonetheless, anything that we ascribe to thought, which means to awareness, to consciousness, to experience, cannot grasp his reality. Thus it follows that v'nimtza, it follows that k'moyshem motzu sham, as he is found there in the highest realities, kach nimtza b'tachtoinim mamish, so he is to be found mamish, in a very real way, in the very lowest realities and worlds. What is the Alter Rebbe saying? He's teaching us here something very special, very powerful. Generally, Kabbalah and Chassidus distinguishes between two types of worlds. Almond is galion and almond stimin, which means revealed worlds and concealed worlds. Revealed universes and concealed universes. What makes up a concealed universe? Concealed universe means that these are the realities that are totally hidden from our vision, because if these realities and these worlds and the energy of these worlds would be exposed and would be revealed to us, it would shatter our patterns. We say each morning before Shema, Hashem forms light and creates darkness. So the Alter Rebbe explains elsewhere. Yotzer, which is lower, forms the world of Yetzirah, is connected to light. And Boire, which is higher, Bria, is connected to darkness, Choshech. But the explanation is precisely because it's higher, the reason why Bria is associated with darkness is not because there is less revelation in Bria. On the contrary, because there is too much revelation in Bria, and therefore for us, it is darkness because nothing of it is revealed in our life. To give an example for this, to appreciate what Alter Rebbe is saying, it's a remote example and it's an incomplete example, but I think it can give us some visualization. In medicine today, there's something called senses integration disorder. SID, senses integration disorder. Where a child or an adult's senses are not functioning properly and superbly. There's a disorder in their integration and in their symmetry and so forth. And they discovered not such a long time ago that very often the cause for it is opposite of what we would usually think. We would think the reason there's a disorder in their senses is because their senses are weak for some reason. But they discover that sometimes the opposite is true. Their senses are too powerful. Sometimes there are children or adults that their senses are magnified 5 or 10 times or even more than our senses. So when these children hear something, it's multiplied 10 times. The same is true when they smell something. When they touch something, their sensation of touch is multiplied 10 times. For example, a practical example. If these children are sitting in a classroom, if such a child is sitting in a classroom and everybody's taking a test, and the teacher demands pure silence during the test, a child is wearing on his wrist a watch, and the watch is ticking. Somebody else, another child, is pounding lightly on his desk as he's contemplating a question. Another child is scratching his ear. Somebody else is banging with his shoe on the ground. And 3 miles away, there's a fire. So if you'll ask the teacher, do you hear noise in the classroom? He'll say, absolutely not. Superb. It's silent. I can hear a pin drop. But this child, and it has happened. This child could stand up in the classroom and start screaming. Stop bothering me. Stop driving me crazy. You're giving me a headache. And everybody looks at him as though he's a meshuggah. He's nebach mad. He lost his mind. His world is not their world. What is reality for him is not reality for them. For him, the watch ticking is not for what it is for me or for you. That sound is multiplied 20, 30 times. Imagine a guy is not scratching his ear. Another person is banging on the table. Another person is banging with his leg on the ground. And there's a fire 3 miles away. He goes crazy.
Isn't there a movie,
No, this is not, I'm not talking about autistic. It's called SID. These people are too sensitive to exist in our world. They're sensitive to things that we're not sensitive. And therefore, they have discovered that sometimes, since their senses are so powerful, it's too painful for them. And it's too scary for them. Because the impact is so intense. So you know what they do? They shut off their senses. And they experience poor senses because they shut it off as children because it has been so powerful. The brain tells them, tune out sounds, tune out visions, tune out voices, tune out aroma. Tune out.
Can they tune out?
They do it. The brain is so scared of the pain. The brain is very fearful. It's fearful. First of all, it's painful to sit in a room with such noise. It's painful. You were disturbed before by noise, right? Right? That was loud noise. And this child is disturbed by somebody going like this, that nobody would even be in here. And imagine it's multiplied. The noise that you heard would be multiplied 20, 30 times. You would run out of this room. It's a very profound therapeutic process. Not only this is true about tzaddikim as well. I once heard from the Rebbe, from the Lubavitcher Rebbe, I heard myself from his mouth a story that he heard from his father-in-law, that his father, the fifth Lubavitcher Rebbe, the Rebbe Rashab, went with his son, who became later the previous Lubavitcher Rebbe. They were once, I think, in Berlin or France, and he went to visit a big professor for hearing, to check out his hearing. So his son, I was surprised. He said, "Tata, what happened?" So he told him what happened. He said that recently he was giving over a discourse in Chassidus in the city of Lubavitch, Shabbos. He came down and he was saying a mimer. When the Rebbes would say a mimer, they were in absolutely another world, to the extent that they would tie a handkerchief on their fingers. And Chassidim would explain. So the Rebbe would always do this. Whenever before he would say a discourse of Chassidus, those who saw, he took out a handkerchief from his bosom and he tied it around his fingers. And throughout the entire discourse, the handkerchief was tied around his fingers. And when he would finish, he would take it off under the table and he would wipe his eyes with it and put it back in his bosom. And the reason for it was, Chassidim always said, went back for generations, that it was simply, they wanted a physical instrument outside of them to hold their souls down from expiring. What Alter Rebbe described in chapter 50, Klais HaNefesh. Their physical body wasn't enough. So they had a physical, tangible handkerchief that they were holding on to that, so to speak, allowed them to retain a very concrete connection with the physical world during the Maimer. And the Rebbe Rashab was saying a Maimer, and he told his son, somebody was speaking in the middle. And it was so painful for him, he said, my brain told my ear to stop hearing. And since then, my hearing has become defected. And that's why he went to the professor. It's not exactly the story we're describing above with these children. It's totally a different story. He describes real Mayasaltalalev, a whole other level. Because his senses weren't magnified, but he heard it, he heard it. The Rebbe compared it. The Rebbe compared it to what the Gemara says in the Nedarim about Avraham Avinu, that he was a master over the limbs of his body. Now, I think this can serve as an incomplete metaphor for the Almin Stimin, the concealed world and the souls that live in the concealed worlds. Where are these Almin Stimin de Le'ela? You think if you'll take a spaceship and you'll fly up 10 trillion light years away, you'll explore the Almin Stimin that the Rebbe is talking about? No. These Almin Stimin exist on 16th Avenue in Bar Park, believe it or not. Just as there are magnified physical sensations and senses, the sense of sight can be magnified, in the sense of hearing, and the sense of taste, and the sense of smell, and the sense of touching. There are also spiritually magnified sensations. And there are souls that are sensitive to spiritual things that the creatures of Alma Dizgalia, of the revealed world, don't even know they exist. So this soul, this human being, picks up vibrations and melodies that if he relates them to regular, ordinary people from this world, they assume that he's mentally dysfunctional, he's mentally challenged. This is what we mean by souls of Almin Stimin, souls of concealed worlds. They're fine-tuned to higher realities. Like the Yanuka we discussed a few weeks ago. This is, by the way, how the Alter Rebbe explains in Torah and in other discourses why Moshe, the spiritual reason why Moshe Rabbeinu couldn't talk. Because what Moshe sees and what Moshe experiences, he can't reveal to other people. It's two worlds. And if he starts talking, if he starts communicating his experiences, they will view him as though he fell off from another world. They simply will not relate to him. They simply will not understand him. And because of that, Moshe became a kvat peh, kvat lashon. He became a human being who almost had an inability to communicate clearly. Not because he didn't have what to say, because he had too much of what to say. He had too much what to say. He shut it off. A person like this can't communicate effectively in this world. And Hashem had to promise him, V'anoichi eyein picha. Dr. Rebbe explains, Hashem said, I will create vessels for Alman Stimmen. I will create the mechanisms for you that you will be able to communicate that which you're experiencing. And that's really the true accomplishment of a Rebbe, of a Tzaddik. That despite the fact that he's so sensitive and he sees what other people don't see, and he's sensitive to what other people are not totally insensitive to, nonetheless, somehow he creates a bridge and he tolerates the reality of the Alman Olam Gluyim, of the revealed ones, and he communicates to them on that level. It reminds me something tangible that happened. I mentioned before the Rebbe. In his early years, the Lubavitcher Rebbe, like the previous Rebbes, when he would say Hasidic discourses, he would sit with open eyes. Because that was the tradition by Chabad all the years. When they would give over Hasidic discourses, my Marim, they would sit with their eyes open. But all the years that I remember, it was never with open eyes. The Rebbe always closed his eyes. Right when he started to give over the mimer, he first closed his eyes. He wrapped the handkerchief around his finger as they were singing. When they finished singing, he closed his eyes. And only after the mimer did he open his eyes, whether it was a half an hour, 45 minutes, an hour or more. So I once heard a story. In the early years, the Rebbe Taka had his eyes open. And then suddenly, one Shabbos, he closed his eyes. So one of the older chassidim went in during the weekend. He said, what happened? So the Rebbe said simply, he said, I was looking at people, I simply couldn't tolerate the machshava zaris, the alien, unholy thoughts that are going through their mind. I couldn't bear it. So I had to shut my eyes. The audience was a different audience. The Rebbe had a different audience than the Alter Rebbe had, and the Mittler Rebbe, and some Chzedekan, and so on and so forth. It didn't take away the Machshav HaZaris. The Rebbe said, I can't say a mimer and see it. He said, I can't say Nishtan Kukim with the Machshav HaZaris. I can't.
He saw Machshav
HaZaris. We look at each other. He was sensitive to other vibrations. These are magnified spiritual sensations. This has to do with Alman Stimmen. And Moshe Rabbeinu essentially says, I can't talk. I'm not made to talk in this world. You want a preacher, it's nice, but it's not me. I don't belong here. In Zohar, they're called Nuneyama, fish of the ocean. Why do you think Rav Shimon ben Yochai spent 13 years in a cave? The physical reason was the Roman persecution. The spiritual reason is Reb Shimon ben Yochai was a soul that landed in this world, but it came from Alman Stimmen. It was molded from a different type of fiber, his body and his soul and his identity. And therefore he was in a cave. That was a conducive place for him. They're sensitive to what we're not sensitive, and they're not sensitive to things we are sensitive to. In any case, there they experience other realities. These are called Alman Stimmen Delayla. Now, so the Alter Rebbe says, comes the Tikkuni Zohar and says, Hashem is Stimu Dechol Stimmen. He is hidden even within the hidden worlds. Even from the hidden worlds, he is also hidden.